Okay, welcome back everybody. This evening we'll do the half an hour of guided meditation, then some chanting, and then we'll have open up the floor for some Q&A. So if you'd like to make yourselves nice and comfortable, find your favourite sitting spot on a chair, on the floor. Wherever you find it most comfortable. So I hope everyone's had a nice rest. So that we can really give our most to this meditation. And so we'll follow the same format. This has worked for me the last 15 years. So I'm reluctant to change the way I meditate. It works well. So we'll start by giving our five senses time to relax. And doing this as kindly as we possibly can. It's an emotional type of mind state to apply this kindness, or Ajahn Brahm calls it kindfulness. It's a mix between kindness and mindfulness. You've got to have a balance of both of those qualities. So using kindness in the right way, that's kindfulness. So we start closing our eyes, taking a moment to notice what we see, what does it look like? Your eyes closed. I've been noticing all sorts of different shapes and patterns as this meditation retreat has progressed. It's been quite interesting paying attention to the visual imagery that goes on when the eyes are closed. And sometimes even these lights and limiters kind of sneak in when you're not looking. They're quite a nice welcome surprise. Maybe you've seen them too. And we move on to the sense door of the nose and the tongue. What do we notice there? You guys have all had supper, so maybe there's something different tasting there. And then moving to the sense door of the ear. Now, what do you notice? What sounds are around you? Give them some attention and apply the kindness. And last of all, the sense drawer of touch. Just moving through the body. This you can do in your own way, but you can find a way that suits you better. But for me, I like to start with the toes and just work my way through the rest of the body. Sometimes I don't go to individual parts of the body. I just kind of scan through quickly. Sometimes I don't get to the body. Kind of the mind just kind of leaps towards the meditation. And that's okay as well. But in this process, it gives us an opportunity to apply lots of kindness. And this always produces a positive result in meditation. So I'm just asking my toes how they feel, give them a bit of a wriggle. And then I move my awareness along the soles of my feet, applying this golden light of kindness. And when I apply this kind of kindness, it also has a tendency to loosen everything up. It makes the muscles and the joints kind of soft and just squishy, and that's how it feels. And it relieves any tension, any tightness. Because this kindfulness, it has a softness to it, it's not hard. So a lot of this meditation is quite emotive, so you've got to feel these things and imagine, and use your mind to imagine this softness and kind of make a connection between your mind and this different parts of your body as you move your awareness from one part of your body to the next. Moving up onto my ankles, my heels, and just moving this kind of loving kindness through the muscles, making them all soft and relaxed, relieving any tightness or tension. I'll move it a bit further up to my knees, just noticing how they feel. My knees are always a little bit cool, so I notice that coolness. So sometimes I need to add some warmth, but today that coolness is just right, it's just perfect. So I leave my knees as they are and move this kindness up the large muscles in my legs. There's lots of muscle there, lots of muscle mass. So it does do a lot of work. So sometimes, just like your tummy, you can thank your legs for the work they do. If it wasn't for our legs working, we wouldn't be able to come to this retreat. We are still able and upright, like it says in the Metta Sutta, let them be able and upright. So we can still walk. So have the gratitude to your legs and just give them kindness, making those muscles nice and soft and relaxed, relieving any tension or tightness. And shifting this kindfulness to the hips, the pelvis, and then just moving this kindness into your tummy. Just all around your tummy, all the different parts of your tummy, sending the metta, this loving kindness into your tummy, having gratitude for your tummy, for the work that it does. And then into the area where your breath is occupied, just flooding that area, immersing that area with metta, loving kindness. May your breath be well, may it be happy. May it be gentle. How does your breath feel? What does the texture of your breath feel like? Obviously, you're feeling it with the five senses. Take a note of how it feels with the five senses. And later on in the meditation, when we move our awareness into the mind, you can revisit how the breath feels without the five senses. Just to get a feeling of what that feels like. How light does the breath feel? How heavy is it? How smooth is the breath? How coarse does it feel? And then moving lastly up through the neck and the shoulders. Again, if you like, give them a stretch. Notice how that feels. I'm sure there's like endorphins or something released. You stretch, it does feel nice. And last of all, just bring your awareness up to your head, around the muscles around your eyes and your mouth. Sometimes those muscles around the eyes are very, very slight, very delicate, small little movements, tiny little muscles. So now we've made our body and its five senses as relaxed as we can. Just very gently shift our awareness inside into the mind, into the sixth sense. Again, taking a moment to notice what it looks like inside your mind and how it feels. What do you see? does your breath feel? Now that we've relaxed the five senses and we're largely kind of in the space of the mind, how does your breath feel now? Does it feel different? Is it lighter? Is the breath smoother and softer? As the meditation progresses, if your breath does become softer and smoother and lighter, and especially if it's accompanied by a pleasant sensation and peace, then it's a good indication that your meditation's moving in the right direction. So for the last half of the meditation, I'll leave you with your mind and your breath. You can hang out together and just see what happens. Just be as kind as you can. Just sit back, observe what's happening without interfering, like a silent observer, just watching what's going on. Happy to be there with no expectations and no desires. Just happy to be here, whatever happens. At the end of the meditation, I'll ring the gong 3 times. Why does that beautiful meditation have to stop? Now we've got to do chanting. So please grab a chanting book if you haven't got one. Thank you, Bert. So those of you who maybe aren't Buddhists, haven't done the chanting before, I hope you had a chance to look at the translations that are on the other side of the pages for the chanting we do. Now these translations are done, by Pali scholars, which we actually have here at Serpentine Monastery. We're lucky enough to have some very good scholars, including Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahmali, and then there's a whole heap of very clever monks, young monks as well, that are good at translating Pali. I'm not one of them. That's okay, because I've got other skills in other places. But so these translations, if you haven't had a chance to read them, they might look a bit lofty and biblical, probably because they were done a little while ago. And they're always retranslating stuff so that they can keep up with modern language. So one of our monks, his name is Bhante Sajjato. He's a very good translator. So he quite often revises stuff like this. So he'd probably give a completely different translation to this. But the essence is still the same. But it's just if you haven't been exposed to Buddhism before and you read it, you might think it looks a bit biblical, a bit kind of not modern language. The Blessed One, stuff like that. But that's the words we use. So, all right, we'll do some chanting, and then after that, we can do some Q&A.
Yo so bhagava arahang sama sambuddho sawakato yena bhagavata dhammo Supatipanno yassa bhagavato savakasangho dhammayam bhagavantam saramam sasankham ime hi sakare hiyataraham arupite hi abhipu jayama saduno bhante bhagava sucira parini bhutopi pachima janatanuka pamanasa ime sakare dugatapanakara bhute patiganhatu amhakangdi garatang hitaya sukaya arahang samma sambuddho bhagava bhutang bhagavantang abhivademi soakato bhagavata dhammo dhammang namasami supatipanno bhagavato savakasangho Sanghang Namami. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Iti piso bhagava arahang sammasambuddho. Vija charana sampano sugato lokavidu. Anuttaro purisa dhamma sarati satta deva manusanam bhuto bhagava tamahang bhagavantang abhipujayami tamahang bhagavantang sirasa namami. Suvakato bhagavata dhammo sanditiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko pachatam vedita bovinyui tamahang dhammang abhipujayami tamahang dhammang sirasa namami. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Ujjupatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Nyayapatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Samichipatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Yadidam chatari purisa yugani atta purisa pugala esa bhagavato savaka sangho. Ahuneyo, pahuneyo, dakineyo, anjali karaniyo, anutarang punyaketang lokasa, tamahang sangkang abhipujayami. Tamahang sangkang sirasa namami.
So really listen to these words, because that's what we've been practicing on this retreat. We've been kind to our bodies, to our mind. It's all in this sutta. Ajahn Brahm says there's enough information in this sutta to get enlightened.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech. humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart all living beings radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Drew over the top, sadhu.
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 There we go. Dedicated to Ajahn Brahm. Wow, there's a lot of good words in there. And not born again into this world. That's one of the deeper teachings of Buddhism. You can ask Ajahn Brahm about that another time. Because that one is... that's a curly question for beginners. I'm not even going to attempt to go there with that one. But a very interesting topic if you want to know more about it. Thank you for all joining in the chanting. It's great stuff. Chanting is it's a good part of Buddhism because you get to have a sing-along. So that's really cool. So this part of the retreat is Q&A. Normally on 9-day retreat... sorry. Normally on 9-day retreat they have Q&A every night. And Ajahn Brahm has 9 nights worth of jokes and stuff to tell. I'm not as skilled as him, so
I'm going to try and squeeze all of my humour into one night. I'll do the best I can. Right. Yeah, so we've got a bit of time for Q&A. So there's questions in this basket. I'm sorry I forgot to tell people about this at the start of the retreat, but did you tell the people about this? Oh, good. So it looks like a lot of people have put questions in. So let's start. Here we go. Can you talk about walking meditation? Thank you. That's a good question, because most people think of meditation as sitting down on the chair or sitting down on the floor, and walking meditation is a bit, it's a bit like, what's all that about? And it is important, especially on a meditation retreat, because it's very difficult to sit all the time. And walking meditation breaks that up. And after all the retreats I've listened to Ajahn Brahm answering questions on what is walking meditation, and how to do it, there really is no way to do it, because so many people answer it differently, and the way Ajahn Brahm has answered it on different occasions. He's talked about going slow and feeling all the feelings in your feet, and then he says, oh, sometimes you just go fast because it depends on your mind state at the time. Ajahn Brahm talks about how he did this walking meditation at the first monastery he stayed at when he was a young monk, and he said he got into a really deep meditation from it. Which is kind of unusual, because the deeper meditation is usually from sitting. He said that he got so into this walking meditation that he'd forgotten about an appointment that he had where they had to do a house dana, and he was supposed to be assembled at this place or at this point, you know, with the car or however they get there, and he wasn't there. And so he was just a young monk, so they sent one of the other monks out to find him, and the other monk found him, and he was shouting at Ajahn Brahm, and Ajahn Brahm was just on another planet. He couldn't hear him, and he said this monk was just shouting at him, Ajahn Brahm, not Ajahn Brahm, would have been Venerable Brahma Wangso, Venerable Brahma Wangso. And he said he couldn't hear him. It sounded like someone so far away. And Ajahn Brahm was so engrossed in this meditation, so slow and just chilled, chillaxed to the max, that he turned around very slowly. And said, what? He was so far away, so you can actually get into some quite nice, peaceful states doing walking meditation. And that's one example. But what I found with Ajahn Brahm's answer to this question is that he just says, just you go at your own pace. There's no right way, there's no wrong way to do walking meditation. You don't have to go slow and feeling every feeling in your foot. If that happens, then that's great. It's just what you do. That's your, you kind of fine-tune your walking meditation. So for me, walking meditation, I start off fairly fast, because it's usually because I don't want to sit meditation, or I know if I sit, I'm probably going to fall asleep or nod. So I do walking meditation. And I usually start off fairly fast because maybe I'm tired, so I just kind of want to wake up a bit. So, and I try to do a fairly long path. Our huts have 18 metre walking paths, so that's about from there over to there, roughly, maybe a bit more. They're quite long, and I just pace up and down quite fast, and after a while I become slower, and then I become more responsive to the things that are around me, the birds, because we're lucky enough to live in the forest, because we're forest monks. So I start enjoying the things that are there. There's no set formula. Got to do this or that. You just you just kind of be with yourself. Try not to let the mind wander off, just like when you're sitting meditation. Don't try not to go into planning and stuff. Just be in the present moment, which is walking. What else is in the present moment? The sounds. So those birds. What else is in the present moment? Your sight. Maybe you glance to the right and the left and you see these birds going along. And one time I remember this, I was walking meditation. I was on my 2-week personal retreat, and I had one of these Australian native trees that's got the really silvery leaves, silvery grey, powdery leaves. And this particular one, and a lot of those ones have the pink flowers, kind of that hang down, and they're absolutely gorgeous. They've just got this unworldly pink colour, so gorgeous. And this particular variety had like a bigger flower and big leathery silver leaf. Anyway, I was kind of walking up and down for these 2 weeks. We have personal retreat. We're silent. We don't interact with anyone. And it's during the rains and rains retreat. And I was watching. I seen this kind of thing on the leaf. It was as big as the leaf. There were big leaves like this. And it was the same colour as the leaves, but it wasn't a leaf. I was trying to work out what it was. So I had a closer look, and I've worked out what it was. It was the hungry caterpillar. And it was eating these leaves, and it turned silver because it was the same colour as what it was eating. And so every day I watched this caterpillar, and I was hoping it wouldn't like go away somewhere, I wouldn't be able to see it, because I'm really enjoying just watching it. Just something simple like that just kind of made my day. And so I watched it, and the hungry caterpillar, it ate one leaf, and then it moved to another leaf. It always left a bit of the leaf. It didn't eat the whole thing. And it ate several leaves, and they were big leaves, and they were leathery, so they were thick. So this caterpillar, it was huge. It was almost as long as the leaf. It was about that long. It was fatter than my thumb. It was like fatter than my thumb. Yeah, maybe about that fat. I'm really enjoying watching this caterpillar do this, and like I said before, doing my walking meditation, watching the birds go by. And then this like out of the corner of my eye, there was this cannonball. That's what I could describe it. This cannonball came along and just smashed into this tree where the caterpillar was. And you know what the cannonball was? Kookaburra. This big kookaburra, these naughty kookaburras. Sometimes they attack people's plates full of food at the monastery over there. And they steal the spring rolls because they like them. And they dive bomb your plate and all the food goes everywhere. We had to sort one of those kookaburras out. How long ago was that? Do you remember, Burr? We had the kookaburra, and Venerable Buddha Rakata got the net, and we caught it and relocated it about 30 kilometres away. It was becoming a nuisance. It was scaring people, and it never came back. Well, I just heard Friday, there's a kookaburra doing that again, so we might have to sort this kookaburra out because it's a very naughty kookaburra. I wonder if it's the same one that's come back. So walking meditation, you've got to tailor it for your own self. And yeah, you kind of just try different things. On a weekend meditation like this, it's kind of hard to find your groove in walking meditation. Plus you've got other people around you, they're watching you. You're trying to walk slow. I remember trying to walk slow in these rooms when I was a lay person, and I almost fell over because it's hard to keep your balance. It's easy to walk fast. So I've seen other people do that too, trying to do the slow walking meditation, then lose their balance and off to one side, end up on someone else's path. So it was a lot easier once I became a monk and no one was watching. I could do my own walking meditation. So that's how I do it. I start off fast and I eventually just get slower And I just enjoy the things that are around me, stay in the present moment, and eventually it just becomes quite peaceful. And just walk up and down. Sometimes you've got to get over the mind that wants to do something else. It's like, oh gee, this is boring. I want to do something else. But you stay with that boredom and treat it as a friend, just like you would do if you're sitting meditation. Treat those mind states like friends and just hang out with them, even if they're uncomfortable. That's what you do with your friends. Even if they're sick or something, you be kind to them, hang out with them. So that's walking meditation. All right, next question. Is counting the breath a helpful meditation for beginners to learn? Sometimes I don't know how to stay present, so counting the breath gives me something for us. Is this okay? Yeah, it's pretty good. I've heard Ajahn Brahm recommend it. For beginners, I think it is pretty good. And I think I did try it myself a few times, and Ajahn Brahm gives these suggestions of techniques for counting. So you kind of go in-breath, one. Then out-breath, two. And then you go backwards to one again. And then you go in-breath and out-breath to three. And then you go three in-breath, two out-breath, one in-breath. And then you go one out-breath, two in-breath, three in-breath, four out-breath. And then you go backwards, three in-breath, and you do this. And you keep going until you lose count and you lose track. And then you have to go back again. And that's supposed to keep you in the present moment, but you end up getting frustrated because rarely you can get past about four or five before you start nodding off or whatever. But you've got to try all these things. You've got to try everything when you're meditating until you find your own groove. But I'm glad you mentioned breath is helpful for meditation beginners to learn. Sometimes I don't know how to stay in the present moment. Stay in the present. So it is important to stay in the present. And when you're tired, it's very difficult. So you come from working, it's going to be very difficult. A weekend retreat, usually by the time for 9-day retreats, it's by the time the weekend's finishes when you're just starting to kind of get your energy up. So you guys have to like really fast track it. That's why I encourage people to get lots of rest so that they could, when they did meditate, they weren't less likely to nod. But that's why I do that body sweep meditation. For me, I found that is the best one to stay present moment. Because it's hard to wander when you're thinking about your toes and then your foot and then your knee. And then if you add kindness to it, you can really stay with it better because you've got gratitude to those parts of your body. Especially for me, I don't know why, but I like giving gratitude to my tummy because it does so much work. Eating all that junk and rubbish sometimes we throw in there and extra cakes and stuff and sometimes your tummy gets sore. So I say, I'm sorry, tummy, for working you extra hard today. And so when I add that kindness to it, oh boy, it's a lot easier. It's quite easy to stay in the present moment. So that's my technique for staying in the present moment is the body scan with extra kindness added on top. It works for me. So, and I have tried the counting. I probably tried it for, off and on, as Ajahn Brahm would suggest it. Because I went to the 9-day retreats with as a lay person, but then I went to them as a monk as well. I would sit up here with Ajahn Brahm on the Q&A evenings and hear the same questions come up, and I'd try those things as well. But I'd say counting's all right for beginners. You can do tricky counting backwards and forwards or just go one, two, three. How else can you stay in the present moment? I think just being kind is the best way. And this is what I've learned from Ajahn Brahm. Because that's his technique, is just so much kindness. And it's in his mantras, make peace, be kind, be gentle. So, I can't help it. I've been brainwashed by Ajahn Brahm. So that's how I teach as well. So you give counting a go, and just remember that, yeah, a body scan is another good way to stay in the present moment. And then when you go into your mind, you're kind of pretty charged up. You've got all this extra kindness. Next question. Dear Venerable Mudu, last night you were describing that beautiful breath. Oh, so nice. You said that one would move through the senses, lay them down, and then focus on the mind. What specifically do you focus on? I'm so used to using my breath as an anchor that I feel lost without it. Yeah, that's true. I think I used to use my breath as an anchor, but I kind of changed a little bit. I think it's still okay to use your breath as an anchor. I suppose it depends what you mean by an anchor. It's like if I hold on to the breath with two hands and throttle it around the neck, then the breath doesn't want to hang out with me. I've just got to kind of like let go. I let the breath come to me in its own accord. And then when it comes, rather than... Yeah, it depends how you define what you mean by anchor, but if the breath comes to me, then I nurture it. I don't even give it a cuddle because that's too tight. I just very gently just welcome the breath to coming into my mind, and I just say, "Oh, thank you for coming to visit me," and I treat it like a very, very fragile little being, like a little bird that's fallen out of its nest, and you've got to like just be so careful with it. Because if you cuddle it too tight, you squash it. The breath is the same. If you're just too tight with it, it disappears. You've probably all seen that. Or maybe some of you have seen that when the breath has come up. It's like, wow, here comes this beautiful breath that I've heard all about. And you get excited and then it's gone. It disappears. That's what happens. And Ajahn Brahm explains jhanas like that as well. Get excited when the jhana, deep jhana meditation comes. And as soon as you get excited, it just disappears. But you learn from that, those experiences. You learn how tight or how loose, how much to nurture this beautiful breath when it comes in. And like I've said before, this nurturing is an emotional type of feeling that you've got to feel for yourself. It's very hard for me to put it in words and describe it. I'm trying to use things like a little bird that's fallen out of its nest, or a newborn baby, you know, how you hold them. Because I've had a daughter, so I know they're little and they're small and they're delicate. You're so gentle when you hold a newborn. It's similar to the beautiful breath. You just kind of welcome it into your mind, and you just handle it with very delicate kind of cotton wool hands, if that makes any sense. The hardest thing to describe these things is you're describing emotions, emotional kind of feelingy things. It's difficult to explain, but I hope I've shed some light on that. I'll describe the beautiful breath. You said to move through the senses, lay them down and focus on the mind. Yeah, so that's how I like to start the meditation, is just applying this kindness to the five senses so that they're relaxed, and so you can put them down just like putting down a cup of water. You kind of hold it too long, it gets heavy. So you put it down and you let it go, and you're free of that burden. And when you let go of the five senses, and it's not easy to let go of them 100%, but 70% is good enough, or any percent is good enough. If you've heard near-death experience stories, they're the best description of letting go of the five senses. So near-death experiences. These people talk about, they come close to dying, or they're dying, or they die. They feel like they die, and they go towards like a white light. Ajahn Brahm describes that as basically, it's just like kind of going toward jhana meditation. Because you die, your mind leaves the body, and the body has the five senses. So the mind leaves those five senses, so you can't feel anything anymore. You can't smell anything, you can't touch anything. You're just kind of this consciousness, the mind. And all these accounts of near-death experiences, or they call NDEs, they always say how beautiful it feels. It's like a bliss. It's the most beautiful feeling. And that's because you're not burdened by the weight of these five senses. The body is painful, gets sore, gets aches. The older we get, the more painful and achy it gets. So, yeah, these guys always explain NDEs as being blissful, because you're detached from the five senses. You just have this pure mind state. And most people also describe this pure white light. And a lot of them describe it as, a union with God. And they say, oh, I'm going to the light. This is kind of, this is what God is. But in Buddhism, we describe that as basically a reflection of your own mind, which we call a nimitta. And this is a beautiful nimitta. This is the ones that Ajahn Brahm talks about that are very worthwhile if you get them. These bright, very, very bright nimittas, brighter than the sun, and they don't blind you, because it's not a visual experience, it's a mind experience. And so Ajahn Brahm describes these nimittas as basically the same as this white light. And some of us have nimittas and they're not these bright white lights, they're just other lights in the mind. But we see those once our five senses become, not necessarily 100% switched off, because we can still hear loud noises and stuff. They kind of, but they're like background, they're like far away, like Ajahn Brahm's description of the monk that was calling out to him, and he was right in his ear, but it sounded like he was a million miles away. So the five senses, that's why I encourage people to put them down to one side, to leave them alone. But you can't do that until you've made them nice and comfortable and relaxed first, and then you focus on the mind. So that answers all that, I think. Using the breath as an anchor and all that. Yeah, you can use the breath as an anchor, but the best for me is, like, I like it when the breath just comes to me, when I don't go looking for it. I just kind of just hang out with my mind, like I said, like treat your mind like a good friend. And after a while, your mind stops running around to the left and the right, and it's almost like another friend. It's just like, oh, Venerable Mudu, You're kind. I don't mind hanging out with you. And it comes and sits right next to you. And you hang out together and get nice, peaceful states. And that's when the breath comes to you, when your mind's nice and relaxed. And you experience this beautiful breath, Ajahn Brahm calls beautiful breath. But you don't experience it with the five senses. You don't experience it with touch. You don't experience it with taste. You don't experience it with the sound. Maybe there's little bits of it, but not much. So how do you experience these things if you don't have the five senses? Well, you experience it in the mind. And it's amazing, because if you've never experienced a beautiful breath before, and that's okay if you haven't, please be patient. And just keep meditating, and one day when you get your everything, all your T's crossed and your I's dotted, it will happen. And you'll know what I'm talking about because you won't be able to explain it or describe it, because it'll be the first time you feel it. You go, what's that? That's weird. Because you're not experiencing the breath with the five senses. You know it's there, but your mind's experiencing it. So it creates this new sensation you've never had before. That's really cool. So for me, every time when I first started experiencing it, and by the way, it is something that monks are allowed to talk about. They're allowed to share experiences of nimitta. And generally speaking, monks aren't supposed to kind of talk about their own experience of anything beyond that. So jhanas and beyond, usually monks don't talk about those things. But I'm quite within my vinaya rules to talk about nimitta experiences and beautiful breath. And so I remember the first time I feel the beautiful breath. It's like, what the hell's this? This is crazy. I can't put a description on it. I'm trying to describe it. This would have been after losing many beautiful breaths through excitement and finally listening to Ajahn Brahm's instructions of nurturing it carefully. Don't get excited. Just kind of just settle down and just be with the beautiful breath. So how did I experience it? Well, this is how one of the ways I experienced it was, so my mind had to create something, and this is how I experienced the beautiful breath. So for those of you who know, let's say nuclear power plants, you probably don't know much about them because maybe you're not in engineering, but you've all seen The Simpsons. So The Simpsons have, I think at the start, and I haven't seen it for how long now? Many years, almost 10 years. But I don't know if it's the same at the start, you know, what do they call that bit at the start where they have the credits? And I think there's an image, where there used to be an image of the cooling towers at the nuclear power plant. So a cooling tower is where they cool the hot water produced by the nuclear reaction at the power plant. They have to cool it because nuclear power plants get really hot. Any power plant gets hot. And you have an excess of heat and you have to cool it down. So they have these things called cooling towers. And they're shaped, they're very curvaceous. They've got a feminine kind of shape. So they go like that. They're round. They're circular and they start off wide at the bottom and they go like this. And they have a hole at the top and all the steam goes out the top. So usually when you see them, they're kind of representative of nuclear power plants. Well, anyway, well, that's what my head turned into. That's how I visualized this beautiful breath. I didn't try and visualize it. It's just, this is what it felt like. It felt like I was breathing through my head and my head was the shape of a cooling tower. And all the air was going in and out through. It's crazy stuff because the first time you experience it, you don't know how to just describe it or how to, so your mind just makes up this crazy thing. Other times I've experienced beautiful breath, and this is pretty cool, is when the beautiful breath comes, it feels like, and my eyes are closed, so the five senses are pretty subdued. They don't necessarily have to be 100% kind of subdued, but this other time it feels like the walls are breathing. The wall's in here, and my eyes are closed, but I'm visualizing that the whole room is breathing. So how crazy is that? So you have these very weird feelings of how the breath is, and there's no drugs involved. No drugs involved in this. This is just what your mind creates. So So this beautiful breath, and other times the experience is just, yeah, the walls breathing is really nice. It's a nice feeling. Obviously, if I opened up my eyes, it would spoil the whole thing, but that's just what my mind imagined. And these days, it isn't really accompanied with a visual anymore. Just in the early days, it used to have this visual in my head that accompanied with it. These days, it's just beautiful breath. It feels lovely. It has a pleasant feeling, and it's accompanied by peace, quite a deep peace. So it's just so nice. I hope everyone gets to experience that one day. And some of the early mistakes people make with beautiful breath is they go, what's next? They want the next thing, the jhanas or the nimittas. And as soon as you want anything, you have a desire. You've all listened to Ajahn Brahm, and that's the end of the beautiful breath. It's gone. So this path of meditation is a path of not wanting anything. So these things happen. They come when you least expect it, when you're not wanting anything. It really is true. That's how it works. So that's quite a long question because you talked about beautiful breath, so I needed to revisit that. I did talk about it on the first night, but I can't stress how beautiful it is to actually experience that, and I hope everyone gets to try that one day. It'll come when you when you least expect it. How can I get rid of thinking or of guilt and worry when I leave my kids and work tasks behind for meditation? Oh, wow. Okay. How much time we got? So there, Ajahn Brahm tells a story about the husband and the wife who. The husband wanted to go on the meditation retreat, and the wife said, "Well, that's great. So you want to leave us at home for me to do all the jobs, pick up the kids from school, do all the cooking, doing all the cleaning? That's really selfish of you. No, you can't go on a retreat." So he waited for the next 9-day retreat to come up, and he asked his wife again, and she said the same thing. How dare you do this, thinking of yourself? It's all you do, think of yourself, not thinking of us. We're at home, I'm doing all the jobs, looking after the kids, taking them to school, doing all the cooking and cleaning. No, you can't go on retreat. And in Buddhism, you know, it's always 3 times for everything. So he asked the third time. "Oh, gee, you're so selfish," she said. "Off you go then. Don't worry about us. You know, we have to slog it out here at home doing all the jobs and leave everything up to me. You go and enjoy yourself. You selfish..." I won't say any more words than that. So off he went. He went on the retreat. And when he came back from the retreat, his wife didn't recognize him. Because he was a changed man. He was more peaceful, more calm. He didn't react. He didn't get as angry. And so when the next retreat came along, she said, "Have you signed up for that retreat yet?" So whoever asked this question, just think of that. When you get home and your kids and your family, you'll be more relaxed and you'll be able to handle the stresses a lot more easy. And on top of that, please don't feel guilty. Guilty is a hard thing to get rid of. I don't know. We're taught to feel guilty from when we're born. Parents tell us off and make us feel guilty, so we carry that with us. But you actually deserve to come on this retreat. Everybody does, because you're setting a good example for your kids too. Yeah, my mum used to go on meditation retreats, and I thought that was pretty cool when I was little. I was a young teenager, didn't really understand a lot about what it was, but I knew that it was something to do with being peaceful and calm. So, yeah, don't worry. You're setting a fine example for your family. Right. How to use loving kindness to help cancer patients. Well, Ajahn Brahm, I keep referring to him because he's such a good teacher and he has so many examples. Ajahn Brahm is actually was invited by the cancer some cancer foundation. They're in Cottesloe. They're based in Cottesloe, and he goes there every year because he went there many, many years ago and gave a talk to the cancer patients. And he gets invited back every year. And some of the feedback he gets from those cancer patients that went to this group, because a lot of them go there, and the Western narrative, which means like the storyline for cancer patients in the West, is that we have a war on cancer. You wage this war against your mind and your body. And the way Ajahn Brahm talks about it is that's ridiculous. You're waging ill will against yourself. There's no way to treat cancer. Cancer has to be treated with kindness. And this is what some of these cancer patients say to Ajahn Brahm. They said, cancer was the best thing that ever happened to me. Fair dinkum. Can you believe that? They think it's the best thing that ever happened to them because they've learned so much about the meaning of life, what is important in life, when maybe before that they were living carefree lives, not being mindful about what they did, how they impacted others. And some of them have... there are some stories where they've actually cured their cancer through the meditation. And it's not always the case, and in most cases it probably isn't. But Ajahn Brahm has taught them, you know, to meditate. Some of them may become Buddhists, I don't know. But they learn to understand that this is having cancer or having any disease or actually just having a body. Sickness is par for the course. Sooner or later you're going to get sick. Sometimes we tend to look at the older people thinking, oh yeah, they're the next person that's going to get sick. It's not always the case, because as we know, little kids get sick and they die. So you just don't know who's going to get sick. So loving kindness, that's what's really important for any patient, cancer patient, any patient. One time, one of these doctors, a young doctor, he's one of Ajahn Brahm's disciples, and he was delivering babies, and one of the babies he delivered, it died. And this young doctor, male doctor, he was so distraught and upset by this. Some of you have heard this story, that he went to see Ajahn Brahm and he said, I don't think I can continue on doing this job as a doctor. I lost this child, this newborn, and I had to tell the parents, and I had to tell the mother. And he said, it was the hardest thing I've ever done. And he couldn't live with that. And this doctor, there was nothing actually wrong with him. Sometimes this happens. Sometimes newborns die. And this is where Ajahn Brahm said to him that, and he uses this a lot, he said that your job isn't always to cure. He says, your job is to care. And that's a beautiful thing that he said. It's true, because you can't always cure everything, and cancer is one of those things you can't cure, but you can care. And doctors can care, people can care, and care, that's loving kindness. So loving kindness definitely has a place for cancer patients, for the people that love them, and also for themselves. Doing metta meditation is a beautiful way, just like we did before, sending that kindness to your tummy. One of the reasons why I like sending kindness to the tummy so much is because one of our meditators in Albany, she had a stomach tumor. She had a stomach tumor, and our Anagarika said to me one day, "Oh, what's the deal with this woman? Why is she pregnant? She's an older lady. Why is she pregnant?" I said, "She's not pregnant. She's got a big cancer in her tummy, the size of a basketball." And she passed away about a month ago. And so every time she came to the meditation, I always just put more kindness into the tummy. And she had quite a peaceful passing, learning these techniques of meditation and putting metta into her tummy, loving kindness. So there you go, there's an example of someone that knew she had cancer. Wasn't much she could do, but she could care for her own body by sending it kindness. So a really good thing to do. Can you recommend or have experience of a Buddhist approach to strange dreams? I sometimes wake up exhausted from a vivid dream, often where I have been hiding or keeping safe from danger, but don't have danger in my life. Well, it's quite interesting with dreams, because a lot of the monks don't really have many dreams. I think dreams, and it's a hard thing to explain, because I remember I studied psychology and we looked at dreams when I was a psych student, and it's very hard. It's like investigating the mind. It's very hard to measure it scientifically. But I do know that a lot of meditating monks, after they've been monks for a while and do a lot of meditation, the mind is quite peaceful. That dreams don't seem to come up as much. Dreams by their very nature are strange. they're always weird. Ajahn Brahms quite often commented not to really pay too much attention to dreams. Some people come and see him and say, "I had this dream and this happened and that happened. What do you think it means? Does it mean I'm going to have this happen in the future?" And who knows? Maybe it does mean something's going to happen in the future. But Ajahn Brahms' advice is always, not to pay too much attention to your dreams. Pay more attention to your meditation. Pay more attention to your wholesome qualities, your virtue, the five precepts, in other words. Kind of work on refining those, and you'll live a very happy life, free from danger. Why do you live free from danger when you keep the five precepts? Even the Buddha said this. He said that when you keep the five precepts, refraining from killing beings, refraining from stealing, refraining from sexual misconduct, refraining from lying and bad speech, and refraining from drugs and alcohol, basically you end up becoming a person that's blameless. When you keep those five precepts in Thai, they say sinha, is that right? Sinha, five precepts. You become blameless. No one can point the finger at you and say, "You stole this, you slept with my husband," because you haven't done anything. You become blameless. No one can point their finger at you. Therefore, you become protected, because no one's out to harm you. It doesn't void you of any karma you've done in the past, like poor old Anguli Mala, killed all those people, the Arahant in the time of the Buddha, killed all these people. He became an enlightened being, but it didn't stop people throwing rocks at him when he went on alms round. He came back all bloodied and beaten. But from the day you start keeping five precepts well, you do get some level of protection. What's the difference between being lazy and being kind to yourself? They're the same. Yeah. E.g., when not doing things, we should do because we feel tired. Real laziness is not putting forth much effort at all. But there's a kind of a fine line between being lazy and being kind. And I'm quoting Ajahn Brahm again. One of the things Ajahn Brahm says, if you're going to travel this middle path of Buddhism, and on one side you have extreme practices where you kind of are too hard on yourself, and the other side you have complete indulgence and super extreme laziness, and you want to travel this middle path, he said, if you're going to lean to one side or the other a little bit, which way would he say to lean to? Does anybody have a guess? Would Ajahn Brahm say, if you're going to lean one way, would you lean towards more extreme hard practices or lean toward a lazy way?
Lazy.
Yes. He said, if you're going to lean one way, give yourself extra piece of cake at the lunch table or have a little bit of a sleep and, be kind to yourself. Okay. Sorry, I'm taking so long to go through these. There's still 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 to go. We're supposed to finish at 9 o'clock, I think. Yeah, so tomorrow, 9:30 to 10. Well, what we can do is I can maybe answer just one more, and then tomorrow from 9:30 to 10 it says Q&A here. I can read the rest of these out here because you guys have been working so hard, being meditating and trying to do walking meditation and squeezing all this into a weekend. You might need to have a rest. So is that okay? Shall I just read out one more and then everyone can have a rest? Okay. And then tomorrow for the Q&A we'll answer the rest of them. Please don't put too many more in. Are monks allowed to play sports? The simple answer to that is no. But I do remember a story where one of the monks went to Karnet prison, which is just up the road, where the monks, it's like Ajahn Brahm will send you there to do your training, to teach, because I don't know why, but it's quite daunting, you know. You've never been in a prison before, and he sends you to the prison, and you get a bit frightened. You think, crikey, what's going to happen? What happens if I get beat up or worse? And that never happens. They're kind human beings there. They're actually human beings, so they have kind qualities. And sure, they heckle you a little bit, if you know what I mean. Heckling is where, so you go to the prison to teach meditation, and because they're rough guys, they giggle and laugh a little bit, and they mutter jokes to their friend under their breath, and they have a bit of a laugh while you're trying to teach. So they're a little bit, I wouldn't say naughty, but cheeky. But that's okay. So that teaches you how to kind of interact with people. So it's quite good. So Ajahn Brahm sent me there. That was my first teaching gig, my first teaching appointment, was at the prison up the road, Carnet Prison. And once upon a time, Carnet Prison didn't even have a fence around it. It's a low security prison. So the people there are they're not murderers and stuff like that. One of the monks went to teach there, and they asked this monk, they wanted to know a little bit about him and what they do at the monastery and how they live. And they said, well, you know, do you, you know, what do they feed you there? And he said, well, we just have one meal a day. And the guy says, oh, that's crazy. We have three meals a day here, you know. And we have whatever we want. We can choose from the smorgasbord or whatever they have there, from the trays. And he said, well, what do you do for fun? You know, do you get to, listen to some music and watch some television? And the monk said, no, we don't do any of that. We just meditate. And the prisoner said, gee, that must be a bit boring. And I think the monk said, yeah, sometimes it is. And then he said, well, what about kicking the footy? Do you get to kick the footy? He said, no, just meditate. And then this is the funny bit. The prisoner said, well, you should come and stay here with us. So he didn't realize where he was. He was in a prison. But the monks, they enjoy being monks. They enjoy being there. And they get a nice balance. They walk the middle path. They start off, maybe they don't do as much meditation as they do as the years go by. They do more meditation, you know. Ajahn Brahm doesn't have a bell that rings at 3 o'clock in the morning. You have to assemble at the hall. Meditation at Serpentine Buddhist Monastery is self-paced. It's so beautiful. Ajahn Brahm allows the monks to develop their own meditation practice at their own pace. They're not forced to do this or that. The only thing mandatory is to come and eat the meal at 10 o'clock. How cool is that? It's wonderful. But, if the monks struggle there, then they actually kind of create a prison for themselves if they don't want to be there. Any place, Ajahn Brahm says, any place you don't want to be, you're creating a prison for yourself. So the monks don't play sports, but they can get exercise. We've got huge property to walk around, so the monks can get exercise walking. There's another question people ask, are monks allowed to swim? Well, there's a grey area there. Monks aren't allowed to frolic in the water, play around like children. But they can actually, they are allowed to swim, and there are some monasteries that are on the water. So we had a visiting monk from Vietnam, and he had a kuti. His hut was just on the beach. And provided there's no lay people around, because we do have rules about kind of exposing our body in the public, so we're not allowed to do that. But this monk had a private beach to himself. So he did swim for exercise, just went out, did a little bit of a swim and came back in. And we have another monastery that's near the beach, my monastery. And we're quite lucky that actually the beach we have there is private as well. So there's parts of that beach, and I've been down a couple of times. I've had a swim myself. So as long as you're not frolicking in the water, you can use the beach for exercise. So, but it is quite a hassle getting down there. So, and the other thing is, Albany is renowned for white pointer sharks. So I visualise the headlines, you know, monk eaten by a great white. So, I don't know what karma I made in past life. Maybe I killed a great white shark. So I'm very careful. So I'm happy actually just walking around the monastery, which is about an hour through beach sand, up and down hills. It's really hard on the legs. So it's good exercise. So I try and do that. So, that's, we got through quite a few questions. And tomorrow we can do some more meditation in the morning, some chanting, have breakfast, and then we can finish off the rest of these questions tomorrow. But for now, I'm going to go and have a rest so that I can be nice and bright for tomorrow. Thank you all for coming along. I'll see you tomorrow. Satu.